Hello. Joe said I should record a spoiler warning for this The Odyssey special. So I am. I mean, even if you know the story, you don't know necessarily what Sir Christopher Nolan is going to do with it. So, yeah, you've been warned. We talk about what happens in the movie, and we talk about what we think of the movie. Ideally, I reckon, you know, any kind of expectation is a cinematic death sentence. You don't want to know what anyone thinks of a flick before you go and see it, especially a Christopher Nolan flick. So, you know, yeah, maybe go and see it before you listen to this. Or if you do listen to this, maybe it will actually plummet your expectations even further. So then you end up might enjoying it. You know, you could say that. Anyway, I think he probably wanted me to do this in like maybe 10 seconds, but I'll just take a little bit more time sometimes with these things. It's a spoiler warning. And have at it, he's back, guys. Mr. Joe Devine's back, properly in conversation with me. So isn't that exciting? All right. Hey, Joe, can I tell you a fable?
A fable?
Well, it's a fable of sorts. Maybe it'll strike a chord with you. It's a fable in as much it's based on reality. And
right.
So when my wife goes away, when she leaves me,
uh-huh.
and she goes off, she works, sometimes she does, she has work that's work away, and I'm left at home looking after the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see her for, you know, maybe a week. This doesn't happen lots, but it does happen. And equally, sometimes I go away for work and then I don't see her.
This doesn't sound like a fable.
No, it is a fable.
Okay.
Should I frame it more as a fable?
Yeah, can you frame it as a fable, please?
Once upon a time...
Thank you.
There were two frogs.
Yeah.
There's
Mr. Ribbit and Mrs. Ribbit.
Yeah, Mr. Ribbit and Mrs. Ribbit. And yeah, they had a kid called Little Ribbit.
Yes, yes.
And Tiny Ribbit. Sometimes Mr. Ribbit, he in the main, actually, not just sometimes, in the main, Mr. Ribbit would go off... And he'd go off to work down the frog spawn factory.
Can you imagine this being told by like a BBC narrator? In the main, Mr. Ribbit went off and worked down in the BBC frog spawn factory, while Mrs. Ribbit stayed at home to look after Tiny Ribbit.
Well, no, that's not Mrs. Ribbit at home. She was whilst also looking after Tiny Ribbit. Was also, she had her work on the side. She also had work as well.
Right. Ribbit.
And the ribbits, how they got through life was they would share responsibility for Little Ribbit.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Ribbit, when he wanted to go out down to see his friends...
Or the lily pads.
The lily pads. Go down the lily pads and have a few jars of pond water.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And maybe a bit of algae.
He could do that. And then equally, when Mrs. Ribbit, when she wanted to go off and bound around the field
yeah.
with the butterflies, he uh-huh. would be at home looking after Little Ribbit.
Right.
The problem was that Mr. and Mrs. Ribbit, you know, they wouldn't spend enough time together,
mm.
you know, that was the thing that was missing. And so then whenever Mr. Ribbit was off down the lily pad or down the frog spawn factory, he'd think, oh God, I've got it quite hard down here at the frog spawn factory.
Yeah.
And equally Mrs. Ribbit, she'd be at home and she'd think, oh man, this little ribbit's quite hard to look after. And it's quite a lot of work in it. It feels invisible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of resentment would brew. And so when they
frog
came
resentment.
Back... Frog resentment. And when they came back together, these resentments would bubble up and spill over into arguments.
Brr.
Ribbit. And It ended in a divorce. It ended where they left each other, you know, because they couldn't reconcile.
This fable's taken a turn. Yeah. Maybe it had something to do with all the time that Mr. Rivet was spending down the frog spawn factory. Sounds a little bit like a brothel.
You know in the story that you're Mrs. Rivet.
I'm Mrs. Rivet.
Well, actually, no, you're Mr. Rivet and I'm Mrs. Rivet. Because you've been off down the frog spawn factory. You've been, you know, been recording World Cup podcasts.
Right, you're talking about me. Understood.
Right, you've left me and I've been
down the frog spawn factory. I've been making more frog spawn.
Right. And yeah. I've been at the coalface.
Yeah.
And we haven't... Hey, what do you say?
Our relationship is in many ways is like a marriage, but in one sense it isn't, and that is that when I go away to do, you know, to help frogs spawn elsewhere, I'm not leaving you with a house full of administrative work to do. There's no real dust that accumulates, you know. There's only digital dust, which is easily brushed away.
Right, but what I'm saying is why the fable, I feel, it's to warn is that I imagine that I know I've got some resentment towards you, and you might have probably got some resentment towards me because you've been working really hard, and right. Me too, but then I have also been doing solo episodes of the podcast and kind of keeping engagement going on, and I didn't want any of that resentment to just hang in the background. I've just wanted to tell you a tale
about frogs. The thing is, though, in your story the frogs divorced and that's the warning. Okay, right, so it's sort of like,
what fable do you know that doesn't end in a warning?
Well, I mean, the video game Fable, you know.
Yeah, well, actual fable though, fables, there's a lesson. And
yeah, but usually, like, even Jack and Jill, for example, if the lesson is don't hang out in the woods, otherwise murderous, you know, potentially paedophilic elderly will gather you up as children.
That's Hansel and Gretel, mate. Jack and Jill, and Gretel, they fell down a hill. That's
Yeah, they fell down a hill into the clutches of a pedo, yeah.
Don't go up a hill. That's the message of that one.
Okay, so fine. But then, you know, isn't the point that of Hansel and Gretel, they escape, they get home, you know, the witch burns. What's the fable there?
Well, they still have to... The horror of killing an old lady.
Trauma? Yeah.
Do you think Hansel and Gretel are bouncing back after that?
I don't know. I mean, maybe Hansel is. Sounds like Gretel's got a bit of a fucking pipe stuck up her ass, you know?
What kind of pipe? Is it a gingerbread pipe?
I don't know. You're Gretel. What kind of pipe have you got up there?
Yeah, no, of course. Yeah, well... You know, Gretel's telling fables.
Right. Sounds like Gretel's telling fibbles.
I just think it's important, like, when you know, and that also that fable applies to me and my marriage as well.
That's what I thought you were talking about.
Yeah, when me and my wife then finally, you know, realise we speak to each other and we communicate, that's when, and spend time together, that's when we realise, oh, yeah, this is why, you know, this is why we're arguing, or this is why we've fallen out.
Well, you and I spent some time together yesterday.
Oh, yeah, we did, didn't we?
I mean, not together, we sat separately.
Yeah, at my insistence, really. I knew it was a good idea. I said we should go to the... I said I'm going to the cinema, I'm going to see 70 mil showing of The Odyssey.
Yeah.
And then you said you climbed on board straight away. You were like, oh, great, I'd love to do that.
Yeah, because I know that's how you invite people to the cinema with you, by just telling them you're going.
I didn't assume that you'd be free, but it was lovely.
That's what you do. We've even heard that story on the podcast before in the very early days. You told everyone about how you invite people. You just say, I'm going to do this thing. And then if they don't say instantly, I'll come, you just move on.
Yeah.
Well, I was excited to go, you know. The main reason I wanted to go was so I could get it out of the way before anyone else said anything about it. And retrospectively, pretty smart, wasn't it? Because since I saw it, all I've heard and seen is people talking about it. And I'm just so glad that I'd already seen it before I heard or saw any of their dull nonsense, you know?
it would have been annoying. I mean, I we'll get to that. The part of the show, but after I introduce it, we'll do right. a section of the show where I read out some reviews. So let's do it. Hello.
Wait. Is the frog bit finished?
Yeah.
I just wanted to showcase how good of a toad sort of sound I can make. Rabbit. Pretty good? Yeah?
Pretty good.
You can go down.
Adam is the host now. The dynamic works better when Adam is the host. Adam prefers to the host. And Joe prefers to the participant. It's better overall when Adam is the host, and Joe is the participant. Let it never be spoken of again. The ghost.
Hello, and welcome to the Movies You Forgot podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmondo, a.k.a. Adam Richmond, in case you're unclear of what my name is. This is the show where we talk about the movies or films that we forgot we'd even seen in the first place. That's the main gist. Of course, this is a little special episode, but we're doing the special. Joined as ever, I'm always joined by my co-host, the real host, Mr. Joe Devine.
Well, you say you're always joined, but you did just tell a quite dark fable with frog characters about how you're not always joined. So in some ways, you're often joined. But this is a special kind of situation now, isn't it? Now that we know there's an alternative, which is for you to not be joined, now that you are joined, it's sort of like a rejoining, you know?
Mm. On today's episode, we are doing, it's a special, it's a We Went to the Cinema special, 2026's Christopher Nolan directed The Odyssey.
Oh, lordy.
Trouble So Hard. Starring, this is all off my head, I'm not reading the letterbox. It's starring Matt Damon,
yeah,
Tom Holland, Anne Hathaway,
yeah,
John Berenthal.
Keep going.
Elliot Page.
I want more.
Charlize Theron.
Another one.
John Leguizamo.
Is it really?
Yeah, he's the blind shepherd.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Lovely turn from Leguizamo.
Yeah, well.
Really lovely turn.
One more? Give me one more.
We'll get off the top of my bonts. Mm-hmm. Oh, Benny Safdie.
Oh, really?
Pops off as Agamemnon. Yeah, he's Agamemnon.
Oh, is that why he doesn't take his hat off?
Yeah.
Keep going. You got one more on you? I know you have.
Ooh, Lupita Nyong'o.
There you go. That's the one I was thinking of.
One of the most beautiful women going, and she plays Helen of Troy, one of the most beautiful women.
Been. Well, she's one of the most beautiful women going, playing Helen of Troy, one of the most beautiful women been, hey? Hey, and next up is Coldplay.
And this, Mr. Joe Devine says, Christopher Nolan doesn't know how to cast a movie. I think you'll find he does.
Well, listen, I just want to make it absolutely clear off the bat. No, you can't say that now. I'm saying right now, it's not because of that nonsense, okay? It's because of other nonsense. Now, I'm as woke as they come. I just want people to know that off the bat, okay? And later I'll explain why.
Cool, so that's what we did. We saw it 70 mil. We didn't see it at the IMAX. Apparently at the IMAX, there's it's taller. You see more of the top and the bottom of the screen. We didn't see the top or the bottom of what Christopher Nolan shot.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to get IMAX tickets.
Also, who cares?
Well, exactly. As much as I love Christopher Nolan, I'm not going to buy 6 months, a year in advance, tickets to a movie. That's just not how I see movies.
Also, people are just so stupid, man. Well, honestly, you'd think from looking online that, like, you'd be mental to go and see this film not in IMAX because you're missing so much more sky and floor. I don't care. I didn't watch the film at any point and think, oh, I wish I could see more of the sky at this point or more of the floor. You know for a fact they've put all the important stuff in the middle because most people are going to see it in the middle. So it's just nonsense, like this kind of parading. It's lunacy. It's lunacy.
Well, it's signalling. It's a signal.
Sure.
It's look at me.
Yeah.
It's not enough to just see a movie. And it actually does, it damages the name Nolan because it becomes a bit of a joke, like, out, because those people then start to become part of the problem. But that's fine. We didn't. We saw Dunkirk together at the IMAX.
We did, at the IMAX, yeah.
Which was phenomenal. But I find going to the IMAX, it's so expensive. It's nearly 30 quid now. Mm-hmm. And unless you can get a ticket right at the back, forget about it.
Forget about it.
And it adds a whole other layer of, I better fucking enjoy this movie.
Yeah, sure.
Which I can't handle. I can't handle. So I'm not going to put that already on a Christopher Nolan movie. So I just want to be able to turn up. Oh, I can see it. I'm gonna take a half day off work. I'm gonna turn up. I'm gonna see it.
On a
I'm
nice
gonna see
big
it on
screen.
My own terms.
On a nice big screen that we saw it on. Now I do want to point something out at this stage, though, Adam. Okay, I know I've taken some of the reins slightly, and that you're still introducing the film, but I think it's very important that the audience know.
It's a long intro.
Yeah. I think it's very important that the audience know at this stage that what they've just heard you do is one of many acts that will come to represent the tightrope that you're walking on this here episode. Very important for you, of course, to maintain the name of Christopher Nolan. That will be your number one job on today's episode. And even when there are things about the film you didn't like or criticisms that you want to give, you'll be working extra hard to make it clear that it's not a dig on Nolan, and anyone that's coming for Nolan is coming for you. Do you know what I mean? It's a delicate procedure, and I can't wait to see how you handle it with grace, I'm sure.
Well, but maybe this is a good time to talk about this specific issue, because I don't know if you've listened to the solo episode I did on One Battle After Another.
Not yet.
That will have come out already, and I would have people, the true fans of the show will have already listened to that. But I speak a lot about Nolan in that, weirdly, even though it's a P.T. Anderson episode.
Right.
But I talk about directors that you kind of grow up with. And you grow up with their movies as they grow up. Like, you might start with their first or second movie, and you track their progress.
Yeah.
And so you kind of hit, your wagon is hitched in some way.
Sure.
To them. And so that is what's gone on with Christopher Nolan.
It's like
for
a
me.
Football team.
It's a football team. And so sometimes they're going to have a bad game.
Sure. Or a bad year.
But sometimes they're going to do something that you don't agree with. We came out of this movie, we came out of The Odyssey, both of us, and we both had the same analogy about how we felt. Tell everyone what did we both say? We both thought the same thing about that. It kind of encapsulated the feeling.
Yeah. This is the perfect analogy review for anyone listening who's also a football fan, or for anyone listening who watched England during the World Cup. Let's put it that way. Because fans of England during the World Cup will note that they did a very good job to make it to the semi-final, but they did go out at the semi-final stage in quite embarrassing fashion, having done it to themselves, they did, and that's what really hurt, as I think Tom York put it. So I think this, the Odyssey for me, and I think perhaps for you, although I won't speak for you.
No, we both had exactly
agree,
the same
yeah.
thought.
It's the England 2026 World Cup campaign of like, yeah, semi-finals, yeah. Do you know, if you'd given me semi-finals before the tournament started, I would have said, sure, I'll take that, because it could have been worse. It could have been worse for sure. Could have gone out in the group stages, you know, God forbid. But when you're there and you really see how it goes down and how you exit in the semi-final, you're really not that happy about it. So I think The Odyssey is England World Cup 2026 of movies.
But particularly that the loss to Argentina, and like it, given that, you know, we'd gone a goal ahead, and then to see us capitulate in that last 40 minutes and just put, you know, put on all that, put on five defenders. And like, right. It felt like Nolan felt like he'd become so close. Like, this should have been a win,
right?
And all the reviews say it is a win.
Yeah, I don't understand that. That's weird to me.
Yeah. Anyway, I felt like we both were more muted on it than me.
Yeah. Well, I wrote my review. Do you want to hear? I wrote my review in front of you. It was very short. It had three lines in it, and these were the lines. Absolutely fine is line one. Line two is terrible casting. Line three is missed opportunity. Adam wanted to give it 3.5 stars, but knows he can't. That was it. That's my review.
Tell me some things you liked about it. And then it's been a couple of days. It's been a day.
It's been a day.
Has anything grown for you in your rearview mirror? Has anything, you've obviously maybe read a few reviews and maybe you've seen a little bit more social media gubbins. Mm-hmm. Say some nice things.
Some nice things.
About the Odyssey.
Mm-hmm. I think it's weird. It's a weird film and I quite like that about it. It didn't go always where I was expecting it to, despite knowing the story. I liked some of the more unusual scenes. So, for example, I quite like the scene. There's a scene where Matt Damon and his crew are sailing past some sirens, some sort of, you know, mermaids who sing. And they're deadly mythical creatures who lure you in with their song and then kill you. And Matt Damon, instead of putting wax in his ears like he insists his crew do, he wants to be tied to the mast so he can be the only living man to hear the siren song. And this is a weird scene where you don't hear the song, obviously, because Christopher Nolan's not stupid enough to think that he can replicate this fantastical notion. So you hear the heartbeat of his second in command, who simply watches him scream in a bizarre fashion. It's a weird scene. It doesn't really amount to much either. It's just, you know, a short trial alongside some of the other trials that the gang encounter. So I like that. I think that's weird. I think the Samantha Morton scene, she plays a witch who lives on a hill and turns Odysseus's men into pigs, and talks about why that makes sense. That's terrific. You came out of the cinema saying Nolan does body horror. I've never seen him do body horror before. I bloody loved it. You know, I mean, for me, the reason that scene is so impressive is because it's probably the only scene in the film with a terrific actor in it, and that's, you know, it's the reason it sings. So I like those scenes in the film.
Yeah, but it's also his reading of that, of the scene, and which is really interesting. It's the skeleton key to understand what the whole movie's about.
That's what you said when you came out of the cinema, yeah.
It is. I had no interest in seeing Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey. I was like, I could care less. Like, why is he telling this old story? And as soon as that scene kicked in, that's when the film really found its feet. And then I realise, oh, this is about something. This is what the story's about. It's about trauma and violence and what men do in war and the ramifications of that. And I was starting to be really compelled by it. And then the whole payoff at the end about, you know, there's a reason why Odysseus hasn't got home for all this time. There's something sitting within him, which I also found really compelling and interesting, and why I really wanted to give it 3.5 stars. It earns its crust. It earns its place. I'm glad this film exists, and I'm looking forward to maybe rewatching it in a couple of years. But yeah, you know, it's that England Argentina moment. It's like, if only there were different key cast choices who just, they could, this film could be, it could have been a 5-starer.
It could have been something.
It could have been something. And it's just as it is. I just think it was very, very solid. And there's obviously, the filmmaking is pristine.
You sound like you've hardened on the film slightly. Softened on it. I think we came out of the cinema thinking the same thing, being in the same place. I've sort of grown further from it over a day. You seem to have grown slightly closer to it. We kind of joked after our semi-final analogy that it's like maybe quarterfinals, and for me it's like 100% quarterfinals. It you called it very, very solid. I think it's solid. It's hard to criticize. It's hard to find obvious problems other than everything just being sort of like just above average. You know, I think there's like, here's some, like, you touched on the major problem, which I'll get to at the end of this, but another small problem, there's just not enough action. So today I rewatched Inception because you've asked me to think about Nolan more broadly. We'll talk about that later. And I thought, oh, I should watch another Nolan film. And I flicked through them all. And I thought, I haven't seen Inception for a while. It's just great, man. It's a fucking great film. And you know what it's full of?
stuff happening, action. It's full of it's not full of like hubris. It's full of stuff happening and it's exciting. And I feel that The Odyssey really lacks that. I think that there are a couple of action scenes which feel very similar, and I'm just not particularly interested in it. And while it didn't feel like it dragged at all, which is a real compliment given the length of the film, I do think it's too long if you're not going to have more cool stuff in it. Even the big bit at the end where, you know, he's like, Odysseus is shooting everyone with an arrow. To be honest, I honestly preferred watching Ralph Fiennes do that in The Return that came out last year. Like, that action scene is boring. So I feel like it's fine. It's above average. But everything's basically just fine. It's just like, this is the first line of my review. It's absolutely fine. And that's all it is.
That's the killer for me, because he can't shoot a fight sequence. And there's too many fight sequences in this that are nothing. They're just nothing. They're fine. Yeah. They're better than like a lot of shit.
Yeah.
But I've got very high standards. I've seen The Raid. We've all seen Raid.
Seen The Raid 2, even.
I've seen The Raid 2. It's not good enough. Like, the fight sequences in Batman Begins suck.
Yeah.
There's the Dark Knight, right? The Dark Knight, there aren't loads of them.
Sure.
But there's the other action, he can shoot a car chase. He can shoot a bank robbery.
He can shoot a car chase, yeah. He can shoot a fun fight that's happening in a rotating wagon. You know, that's cool. The thing that makes the fight scenes in Inception more interesting is the environment that they're happening in. But there's a lot of like shooty gun time that is just very dull, very dull. You know, there's also this thing that happens where he holds back showing you what happens inside the walls of Troy. I mean, you know, they sack the city, right? No one's going in to watch the film not knowing what happens in there. But he holds back on showing you until the end of the film. And I understand that this aligns with the emotional arc of the film and Matt Damon's story of trauma. But it's also quite boring when they're in there. I mean, I just finished rewatching Game of Thrones, which is a TV show that has numerous problems, right? One of its problems isn't filming fight scenes, right? Watching Jon Snow in the Battle of the Bastards is absolutely amazing. And there's no way on earth that Chris Nolan, with the money he spent on this film, shouldn't be able to recreate a scene better than a TV show did with a guy fighting in the middle of a battle. There's no reason why that shouldn't be the case. But it's boring.
A long time ago, I was in Burma. My friends and I were working for the local government. They were trying to buy the loyalty of tribal leaders by bribing them with precious stones. But their caravans were being raided in a forest north of Rangoon by a bandit. So we went looking for the stones. But in 6 months, we never met anyone who traded with him. One day, I saw a child playing with a ruby the size of a tangerine. The bandit had been throwing them away.
So why steal it?
Well, because he thought it was good sport, because some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burst.
I'm going to give you some reviews, because mm-hmm. you said this film's fine.
Yeah.
What's everyone talking about?
Okay.
People are throwing out 5 stars for this flick. People are throwing out, okay, and that's all I'm going to say. So, not all I'm going to say, I'm going to say more. So here we go. Peter Bradshaw.
Bradders.
This is a film with thrilling ambition, boldness, seriousness, generosity and flair. There are some broad brush moments in the dialogue, yes, but even these are applied with a muscular flourish. It is gasp-inducing. IMAX-sized landscapes of loneliness shot by cinematographer Hoyt van Hoytema. who incidentally avoids the Siege traditional cliched colour, and full tilt battle sequences and fight scenes accompanied by the throbbing and thrumming of drums. The result is a gigantic, shimmering mirage, a mysterious three-hour vision of crazy episodes that does not yield up wisdom or contentment, but only a grim resolution to continue with the fight, to make sense of ruined lives, to re-enter the scorched battlefield of loss. Peter Bradshaw loves this movie. IndieWire. Nolan's casually radical translation uses its mythic setting to smuggle in his most grounded exploration of his faith in the mechanics of the world. The unadorned dialogue, heightened by a cast of Brits all speaking in American accents so as to convey a total lack of effort, affect, aims to strip the Odyssey of the liberal arts prestige that has crusted around it like bedsores over the years. Purists might flinch, but the approach works brilliantly in context, as Nolan strips away anything that might interfere with the rough and ready immersiveness of his spectacle. One more, Empire, another five-starer. By his journey's end, Odysseus seems heartbroken at the state of the world and his role in its downfall. There is something of Powell and Pressburger's The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp in its coda, in a military man mourning the death of honour, as well as echoes of Nolan's own work. Like Dunkirk, it laments the absurdity and pointlessness of war, and like Oppenheimer, it trembles at the catastrophic failures of a great and terrible man. It may be set in a mythical universe, but Nolan is again raging at the folly of a humanity we might recognize on an enormous IMAX-sized canvas. Nobody does it better. This is the critical temperature of the moment, Mr. Joe Devine. You know, you've come out, you've gone, this film's nothing. This film is nothing. I'm not saying you're wrong, because we have, I feel like we're different sides of the same coin.
Sure.
What does one do with that?
Well, I mean, one seeks to understand the motivation behind them. I mean, in Brad's case, it's not a surprise, because Brad's is nothing if not a contrarian. Okay, so like, I'm not surprised at all to see Peter Bradshaw give this 5 stars. And also, I genuinely believe he thinks it's a 5-star film. There's nothing wrong with that either, right? If you're Peter Bradshaw, I'm sure you'd love this film. It is. It's weird. It's, you know, it's unusual. It does do things differently. It is bold. It takes some risks. I think that's fine. I don't know who the IndieWire writer is, but whoever that is
David Aylrich
is clearly just doing an anti-snobbery thing. You know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with like classics people liking classics. I think by the sounds of his review, he's decided that it now is no longer allowed to belong to intellectuals who previously were the only people who continued to read this sort of thing. And that Nolan must have consciously decided for everyone to speak in an American accent and for Tom Holland to use the word dad instead of father, because, you know, he's trying to prize it away from the clutches of the gatekeeping middle classes, which is just fucking nonsense. Obviously, it's complete nonsense. I don't know what the purpose for the accent thing is. I personally think it's weird. I think just have the British people speak in British accents, have the Americans speak in American accents. It's absolutely fine.
It's the money thing. It's not, it's like speak, they're just, they speak, there's, you queried why is Tom Holland not speaking in his accent. He's American. He's basically American. Everyone knows him as an American Peter Parker.
Sure, sure.
He has the same accent.
Yeah, I mean, he does the Spider-Man voice. And in fact, he does the Spider-Man face and the Spider-Man acting in the film, because
he doesn't have any range.
Okay, we'll get to that. And then the third one, I remember you saying once before on one of these episodes that reviewers have to say something. And when an opportunity comes around as big as The Odyssey, this is the biggest film of the year. My Twitter feed is just flooded with people talking about The Odyssey. This is a big opportunity to be heard on something. And I think nobody will read a review that says this is fine. It's either they hate it because it's bawdy and it's got black people in it, or it's got trans in it, or it's like a defacement of old Greek culture, or it's inaccurate, or
you know, it's whatever, shit and boring, and they hate it. Or they love it because it's, you know, a bold vision of cinema, and if you don't get it, then you're an idiot. Or it's, yeah, it's prizing high art away from the wealthy, or it's doing any number of, like, ideological things that it isn't doing. It's fine. It's absolutely fine. And I, apart from Bradders, who, you know, you've got to give it to him for his consistency in being a contrarian.
But he's not a contrarian. He's consistent with all the other reviews. If anything, I would respect him more if he'd come out and going. I'd respect him more if he'd came out and given it 2 stars, and given him a kicking. But he's not. He's not a contrarian. He's got no backbone, and he's come out and gone, oh, which way's the wind blowing? It's always which way's the wind blowing with him. And it's like, oh, hang on a sec. I know all my mates. We've already chatted. Everyone's giving this 5 stars. They say it's a masterpiece. I'm not going to say it's a masterpiece. I'm going to say it's a masterpiece. And so he says it's a fucking masterpiece.
Guess what? It's not a masterpiece. It just isn't.
Of course it's not. Christopher Nolan, he's not made his masterpiece yet. Maybe.
Well, no, let's save that. Let's save that.
Yeah, let's save that.
Let's save that. Can I talk about the casting then?
Yeah, no, let's do the casting.
First thing I'll say, before the film came out, when I first saw the cast, I said, this is a problem. And then I watched the trailers, and it was obviously a problem from the trailers. And bear in mind, I tried to avoid reading anything about it in the last couple of months. I did watch 1 or 2 of the trailers, but that's it. I haven't read anyone, even ordinary people, talking about it. I've disengaged from conversations about it because I wanted my opinion to remain as neutral as possible. We went to see the film, and surprise, surprise, the casting is a problem. I then came home and looked on social media and realized that everyone else who says the casting is a problem is talking about Elliot Page and Lupita Nyong'o. Elliot Page, playing a soldier, doesn't matter at all. Lupita Nyong'o, black, playing Helen of Troy, who is, you know, historically described as having blonde hair, doesn't matter at all. In fact, it was quite fun to go in not knowing, as a bit of a liberal litmus test, not knowing that this was a big online controversy, and realize that I didn't think about either of those things at all while I was watching the film. I didn't even notice until I came home and looked on social media and everyone was complaining about it. So just to be very, very clear, the casting problem that I am talking about is not the controversial casting of a trans man and a black woman. I couldn't give a fuck about that.
Well, of course not. I mean, Elliot Page is fantastic in this flick. It's like,
perfectly cast.
When he rises up as one of the dead, that scene is... he's fantastic. And Lupita Nyong'o, as I've said repeatedly, she is one of the most beautiful women, you know, on the planet. And so why wouldn't you have her as Helen of Troy?
Sure.
She's completely under and unused generally in Hollywood. It's absolutely bad. Again, I'd probably attribute that to, you know, institutional racism within Hollywood. That's just me. The thing is, you were so anti the casting before we went in. I was all jazzed. I went, oh, we're going to the cinema. I was all pumped, and you were like, calm down. And you're like, oh god, the cast. And you just went, the name Hathaway got mentioned, and you were just going, Hathaway, oh my god, the most inauthentic actress of all time. Have you seen those Arsenal videos?
Have you seen one?
What
yet?
The fuck are you talking? Listen, completely irrelevant.
It's not irrelevant. I don't hate Anne Hathaway. I think Anne Hathaway gives some of the least authentic acting performances of our modern era, okay? And the crying, there's a crying scene in this film that is fucking picked from every single other Anne Hathaway film. You know what she's terrific at? She's crying. She's so good at it that she does it exactly the same way in every single film that she's in. She is, as far as I'm concerned, not an actress that can transport me or transform my viewership in any way other than negative in the vast majority of films that she's in. I don't understand why Christopher Nolan keeps picking her. I don't understand why broad audiences like her. I find her to be unwatchable in most things. I don't believe anything she says. I never unsee Anne Hathaway, ever. I just watched Inception. I spent 3 hours watching Mr. Cobb, not Leonardo DiCaprio. Every Anne Hathaway film, I'm watching Anne Hathaway do acting.
Tom Holland, I feel like we can just dismiss fairly quickly. He's very poor in this. He's got no business being in this movie. He belongs in a big action movie making quips. Mm-hmm. And I love him as Spider-Man. I think he's a great Spider-Man.
Yeah, he's a great Spider-Man, sure, yeah.
I really liked him in Uncharted, which isn't a great movie, but he works. That's exactly his speed. Mm-hmm. But he's got no business in this movie.
No.
Anyone else? Like, I love Christopher Abbott, for example. I'd love to see Christopher Abbott in it. He's probably a little bit old for this, because Telemachus is supposed to be sort of, he spans from 16, I think maybe 20. I can't, maybe he should go an unknown for this, but it is a young, Telemachus is a young lad. He's a proper young lad.
Christopher Abbott is 40. He's too old.
Yeah, he's too old. A young Christopher Abbott, but yeah, like someone
a,
like
a
him.
Good actor, good young actor. A good actor who's young. I agree.
But even Tom Holland's probably a little, he's pretty, probably a little bit too old for Telemachus, but he's, because he's got a baby face.
He's got one thing. And that's fine. You know, it's really good. It's a really good thing. But it's just one thing. And it's good that he probably knows that now. And he should spend more time either trying to find another thing, absolutely fine for him to do that, or just keep doing that one thing he's got. You know, loads of us only have one thing, and just some of us just keep doing that same thing. No shame in it. It's fine, you know. But it doesn't belong in the film. It's Nolan's fault. It's not his fault. It's not Anne Hathaway's fault. It's Nolan's fault.
Well, listen, I agreed with you when we came out on that. It's not his fault, because this film cost $250 million. $250 million. It's his most expensive movie to date. I think you seem to be of the opinion that Nolan's got carte blanche in terms of who he casts in this movie. And I think I agreed at the time. I think that's wrong in retrospect, because in a smaller movie, maybe a $100 million movie, maybe he can push through another actor. For a $250 million movie that's got to play the world, I think there are certain names that the studio are going to go, yes, you can have $250 million for a fucking Greek epic that no one gives a fuck about, but we are going to need, this is the list of actors you get for these parts. And I think that's the compromise. The film is compromised. And he wanted to make it. He wanted to make this movie. He wanted to make it for years. And that's it. That's the price of admission.
I mean, then it's still his fault, because he then shouldn't make it. If he's only allowed to make The Odyssey,
that's nonsense.
By putting, you know, Tom Holland and Zendaya in it, then he'd be better off not making the film.
I disagree.
I mean, so do I. I'm just saying that to be inflammatory. I feel that way about it in this moment. I feel angry at the notion that for one of the great living directors to make a big film of a story that survived 2,000 years, you've got to put fucking Spider-Man and Zendaya in the film. I'm embarrassed to be part of a culture where that's the case. I'm sure you're right, but it's just such a shame because they don't have anything to offer in this film.
Right, but it's because his demands of it are, I want to shoot it, all of it on an IMAX camera, and I want everything to be real. And it doesn't need to cost $250 million, but his version of it has to cost $250 million. He could make this smaller and use more CGI and make it for $100 million, but he doesn't want to do that. And so his priority is the $250 million movie, and then that means It's either Tom Holland or, I mean, who else is it?
I don't know.
Timmy Chalamet.
Anyone, right?
Timmy Chalamet.
I mean, I suppose, I think, you know, the other thing is there'll be people who, you know, maybe Nolan included, who would think, well, why not put Zendaya and Tom Holland in the film? They're two stars of a Gen Z generation of people who otherwise might not come and see an ancient Greek epic turned into a film. So I think, I'm sure there are positive spins on it as well. I speak only for myself, not for the world, not for anyone else. Personally, for me, it's a mistake, because they're shit. And they obviously would be shit. Like, it's not, you know, I don't doubt Chris Nolan's powers as a filmmaker, I do doubt his ability as a director to get an Odyssey-like performance out of Tom Holland. It's just not there. I think anyone looking can tell you that. And if this is the price of admission, then fine. Okay, then it's a moral, ethical question as to whether to pay the price of admission or not. Fine. You know, we can come down either sides of that fence or not. It doesn't make any difference. But, like, don't tell me that you looked at Tom Holland ever and thought, yeah, that guy, he's right for this role. There's just no way on earth he could ever do this. And I'm sure did Christopher Nolan trick himself into believing that he could? Does Christopher Nolan think, I'm Chris Nolan? And this would be fair if he did. I'm Chris Nolan. I can fucking get a performance out of anyone, you know? I'm an amazing film director. I'm one of the best film directors alive. What a great challenge. Well, you know, I've made the Batman trilogy. I've made comic books cool and dark. I've made Dunkirk with all, you know, horrible sounds and stuff. I've done Oppenheimer in a three-hour weird art classic that became one of the best-selling movies of all time. I can do anything. What better challenge for what better Mount Olympus for a man like that than to try and get a good performance out of Tom Holland in a film like this?
It's a mistake, all right?
Yeah.
It's Thomas Tuchel putting on Dan Byrne and packing his back line in the last four.
Did you see though that also you didn't see, because you said when I asked you about another interview, like, I don't watch that stuff, but I saw another clip with Tom Holland and Zendaya, and Zendaya was saying, like, she was like, oh, of course I read the script when Tom had it. I wasn't supposed to, but I read it anyway. He went off for his audition and then he came back and he said, hey, read it again, but this time with Athena in mind, right? It's like, you know, she finds out that she's potentially getting the job through his audition. And I just can't imagine anything more Hollywood than that, right? Like, these young people, the world has just been fucking served on a plate to these people. Chris Nolan's sending a script home and saying, yeah, why don't you get Zendaya in this as well? She's not really in the film. I mean, listen, he's got sense enough to, like, not give her many lines or anything. Clever. That's if he'd done to Tom Holland what he did to Zendaya, then I'd be on board more. If Zendaya, he just like that's the way to pay the admission price, right? That's the way to get the $250 million, is to say, yeah, we'll have Zendaya in the film, but then just have her in three scenes, like walking around as a ghost that isn't even really there. That's literally a description of Zendaya in the film.
You had the temerity to call me a cynic on WhatsApp today.
It's because you hate Thelma and Louise.
I don't hate it.
You said you literally texted me yesterday to say you hated it.
Absolute nonsense. I didn't say I hate it. I said it was fine.
No. You dug down more.
That was just being funny. But you're Mr. Cynic at the minute. You know, that interview you saw, that's marketing. Uh-huh. And you think marketing's reality, and that's annoyed you. That didn't happen. You do know that didn't happen.
I don't know that didn't happen.
Of course it didn't happen. It's just some bullshit thing. And you're on Instagram watching it and you're getting angry.
You're saying this to me while you're calling me cynical. You're literally saying a story that someone has told isn't true. But I'm the cynic.
They've obviously made it up. It's marketing bullshit.
Right.
And like, I think that's gross. I don't think it's not gross. But you're getting wound up by stuff that's just bollocks.
No, I'm not wound up by the fact that she reads the script at home or he brings the script home. I'm wound up by the fact that this couple just have all these things. Why do they get to be in the Odyssey? They don't deserve to be in the Odyssey.
Why do you love the Odyssey so much? Why is he so protective about the Odyssey? No one gave a fuck about the Odyssey.
Hey man, it's like I'm the real Chris Nolan fan here. You're the fake fan that's just trying to like defend him against everything.
Oh, you mean Chris Nolan's?
I'm fucking pissed off. Yeah, I'm pissed off because he only makes one film every 3 years. And this one obviously was going to fucking suck. And now I've got to wait and watch another one. And does it suck compared to other films? No, because it's absolutely fine. Right? It doesn't suck compared to the average film. Does it suck compared to Nolan films? Yes. Yes.
But you don't give a fuck about Christopher Nolan. I do. Why do you care?
No, I like Christopher Nolan because I want to bank on the fact once every 3 years that there's going to be at least one film that I'll go to the cinema and see and go, yeah, that was cool. That was fucking cool, man. Even if I don't go, that's a great movie, I want to go, yeah, that was fucking sick. I had a fucking great time in that film. And guess what? I didn't feel coming out of The Odyssey. I didn't feel that. I felt like, oh yeah, good. 3 years, every 3 years.
Well, let's talk about dynamic. We know it's using the air shaft. We
Let's finish off the casting with Damon.
He's the least shit bit of the film. Not in general. The least shit of the worst cast. You know what? He does an admirable job as himself. Well done, Matt Damon. You weren't as shit as I thought you would be. You upped your game. But guess what? Still not good enough, obviously. And, again, like, he really, I think, symbolises the problem with the shit cast of The Odyssey, that this film is absolutely fine because it's made by a very good director, because the actors all do serviceable jobs, because the script has been considered, because there's a through line, because it ticks lots of different boxes, right? But there was an opportunity with this film for it to be lifted by truly great performances, and it isn't in any of those key areas. And it isn't by Matt Damon. He does a good job. He does a very good job. But it's just not anywhere near what it needs to be to lift that to be a 4-star film.
I mean, my issue is I don't have any sense of who Odysseus is.
No.
And I don't know whether that's the script or the performance. Depending on what mood I'm in, it might be like, is it the performance or is it the script? I think the similar thing plays out in a secondary role, which was my biggest disappointment, which is Robert Pattinson playing a more villainous role. Mm-hmm. And I really like Robert Pattinson. I thought he's going to be really fun in this. And his performance kind of veers from overtly very Pattinson villainy to then at other times he's playing something more subtle and then like or likable, and it's really jarring. And I kept thinking, I don't like this. I don't know this character. Yeah. I don't buy it. It's like, has something been lost in the end?
The character's supposed to be two-faced, right? It's a two-faced character who's only fully exposed towards the end of the film. But I agree with you. It's kind of jarring when he does it.
But he does. There are moments where he plays. He looks genuinely human and worried, but just for us, for the audience. So that's not two-faced.
Sure, it's confusing.
And the rest of the time, he's really licking his lips and he's calling Telemachus a snivelling little bitch. Yeah. And then I feel like I've seen Pattinson do this. Put anyone else in that role and don't have them lick their lips and be so obviously villainous. Mm. So I gave you a task, Joe. Mm. I said I want you to rank me your Nolans now. I haven't done this. I haven't ranked my Nolans in my head. I'd have to do it blind, but I'm not going to rank my Nolans. But I want you to rank me your Nolans.
Can I make a prediction?
Yeah.
You're going to rank your Nolans as soon as you've heard me rank mine. Okay. Let's see. This was very hard to rank my Nolans. This was very hard. I can tell you a couple things. One, The Odyssey is not the bottom of the ranking.
Ooh.
Not the bottom. And so I think people might be, again, I will remind people, I thought this film was absolutely fine. I know I've been livid about it for the last half an hour, but it's a firm 3 out of 5 stars, you know? The lividness comes from my disappointment, from the sense of potential missed, as opposed to shitness existing. I've excluded Following, Insomnia, and Batman Begins because I haven't seen them. Okay.
Okay.
So that leaves me with 10 films to rank. Should I start at the bottom or start at the top?
Bottom.
You want me to start at bottom? Okay. Bottom of the 10 films is The Dark Knight Rises.
Okay. And a few words about that?
I think it's fine. It's absolutely fine. It's less absolutely fine than The Odyssey. I think it's too long and a bit boring. And it also, maybe it is a victim of the fact that it follows The Dark Knight, which is much higher up this list. And it doesn't really live up to that second in the trilogy. But I also just feel like, I'm not sure what happens in what Batman Begins feels like, because as I said, I haven't seen it. But I often feel like I just don't really care about Batman in The Dark Knight Rises. Bane is sort of interesting in some ways, but not overly. And so whilst I don't think it's a bad film by any stretch, it is at the bottom of my list.
Yeah, no, I think that's, I don't mind that. That's fine.
Don't mind it? Yeah.
Keep going. Don't mind it.
Okay, second bottom in ninth, Tenet.
Yeah.
Again, absolutely fine. Watched it 1.5 times, got a bit bored the second time. Felt like I broadly understood what was happening. Didn't really help me enjoy it anymore. I think Robert Pattinson's very good in that film.
He is. Yeah.
I really like him in that. I like, what's the name of the main guy?
John David Washington.
David Washington's really good in that film. There's lots of things to like about it, but it's a bit cold and I didn't feel anything watching it. And I don't find Chris Nolan's films to have emotional stiltedness very often. I think it's not one of his problems as a director. He's usually pretty good at creating swells of emotion. But Tenet doesn't really have them in for me, and so that's why it's lower down the list.
As good as John David Washington is, he doesn't quite have the emotion that the part requires.
Right.
Who's next?
Matt Damon's The Odyssey is number 8 on the list. Okay, so that's where The Odyssey comes in. And for not dissimilar reasons to Tenet, to be honest. It's really good. There's things to enjoy about it. I probably will watch it again at some point. I didn't feel anything at any point during the film. I didn't even really care that Matt Damon was killing the bad guys at the end. I wasn't emotionally tied to the film in any way. So while there were lots of cool things happening, it felt cold to me and I didn't care about it. Yeah?
Yeah, good.
Okay.
It's a good list so far. I like it.
Okay, this is where you like the list less, I think, because in its 7, I've put Memento.
Yeah, I mean, that's just insane.
Right. Okay. No, it's in 7. In 7, not insane.
Yeah. I mean, we all know what you think about Memento, so just skip on.
Well, I think I should say some words about it because I've said words about the others. If you want me to. I can skip on if you like. No,
I'd love you to say some like absolutely meaningless words about one of the great films of all time. But
yeah,
sure.
Similarly, for me personally as a viewer and my personal sense of self and me, my individual me, individually and personally me. Similarly, I don't feel anything about this film. I just don't get... I don't have any emotional connection to it. I think it's cooler and sharper than the three that it comes before. I think it's a more successful film than the three that come before, but it's still cold to me. And what I prize above all else in films, of my experience of watching films, my personal experience, is some form of emotional connection. I've watched this film 4 times. I've never felt anything about it. And so, again, this is where you really can emphasize that this is my ranking. This isn't my ranking of what I think necessarily the best of films are objectively. This is my ranking of Nolan movies. I'm sure it would be higher up the list for you. But where would it be? I mean, maybe at the end you get to tell me where Memento would be for you.
Maybe I'll have to do my whole list.
Maybe, yeah, see, that my prediction's coming true. Okay.
Yeah, who's next?
Number 6 is Interstellar. It's higher up the list than I thought it would be. But it doesn't really belong below any of the ones that came before it, unfortunately.
What do you mean unfortunately?
I'd love to put it lower in the list because I don't like the film, but I think it's Christ. A better film than the ones that come before it, and so I've got to put it there, unfortunately. I find it annoying. I don't like people who think this is one of their favorite films. I don't like them as people. I'll just will never be friends with someone who really, really, really liked this film.
I really, really, really like this film. It's not my favourite film.
I'm just goading you. This isn't one of your favourite films. Come off it. I'll give you Memento, but you're not allowed to say Interstellar is one of your favourite films. That's outrageous.
The last time I watched it, which is fairly recently, I thought this film is effing phenomenal.
Sure. Well, you've got kids, so it's like manipulating you into thinking that or something. I don't know. I don't care. I find it, again, like Anne Hathaway's in it. Fucking Jesus Christ. Like, way to sap my enjoyment of any film. Also, Mr. Texas is just not, for me, he's just not like one of Nolan's better leading men. Not interested in it. It's very long. I find that it seems one of those films that's very sort of satisfied with itself in quite an annoying way. I'm only saying that because I knew it would upset you. Sorry. I'm just trying to,
revealing a lot of yourself. All of this. The film is a mirror.
I don't really think that. I'm just saying that because I know it upsets you.
And you are self.
I don't care for it. I think it's too wet for me. I like a film that's a bit wet, but this one's just gushing. Too much for me.
Yeah.
Next up, okay, we're in the top five now, and it's, tell you what, competition for places around here, very tough. Five and four, they're almost interchangeable for me.
Okay.
But in at five is The Prestige.
Yeah.
It's just terrific. It's a terrific film.
Phenomenal.
It's really, really good. I feel like, for me, The Prestige is most similar to Memento on this list, but it makes me feel something when I watch it, and it feels like it's got more sprawl to it than Memento does. I really like it. Plus, I love me some Hugh Jack, and I can deal with the fact that Christian Bale's in the film. So it's just if I made that, I'd be happy. I'd be done. I'd go, cool. I'm never going to make a film better than that again. It's Chris Nolan, so it's fine. He'll make other better films, but that's just such a terrific film to be your fifth best film, as far as I'm concerned. And then Dunkirk is number four, which is, I don't love Dunkirk really, but whenever I watch it, it's just hard to deny as an experience and as a film. There are things I don't like about it. You know, I don't like Ken Branagh standing on the end of the pier saying, you can practically see home from here. I find some of those things annoying. I find Harry Styles being in the film about as annoying as I find Tom Holland being in The Odyssey. You know, so there are drawbacks. But as far as cinematic experiences go, it's just terrific. And I think it's, you know, it's one of the first, maybe, where we start to see Nolan kind of edge towards the weird, like, non-linear time dilation thing the tone of his films shifts. It starts to shift, I think, around 2010, around Inception. But I think Dunkirk is the first one that's, like, in the vein of what Oppenheimer and The Odyssey would be. So it's like, for me, it's the one that turns Nolan into what he is now. And Tom Hardy sailing silently in the air in a plane that's dead is just such a fantastic scene. Love that. Okay, top three. Number three is Inception. I think it would have been there regardless if I watched it today. It's just so good. I think it's absolutely brilliant. The first 15 minutes are amazing. Just, you know, loads of action. You're thrown straight into it. You learn so much about the story of the film without really feeling as though you have to do a lot of homework to get it. It is, you know, the joke about this film was always, it's a bit complicated. Dreams within a dream. It's not complicated at all. And Chris Nolan does an amazing job of explaining it to the audience repeatedly in a way that helps everyone to be able to enjoy this. I think this is one of the peak achievements when it comes to exactly what we talked about when we discussed the IMDb top 100, you know, the ranking system that it used, that combination of critical acclaim and mass appeal, Inception, and in fact all three on at the top of this list, Inception is at the peak of creating something which has mass appeal, which is accessible to all audiences, but is you know, fantastic, has fantastic critical acclaim as well. And Leo is just amazing. He's so good in that film. He completely sells the emotional core of it in a way that Matt Damon could never hope to do with The Odyssey. And when you watch Inception and you experience Leonardo DiCaprio in the lead role, you understand that's why he's a leading actor. That's why he gets these roles, because he can sell it in a way that other people can't. I think he's underestimated for that part. I don't think he gets enough credit for doing that. Number two is The Dark Knight. I think it's amazing. The reason it's not number one is because I think the reason it's so good is not all to do with Chris Nolan. I think Heath Ledger's Joker is just you know, a truly iconic character performance that lifts the whole film.
Yeah, but who cast him? Sorry, who cast him?
No, of course, of course. Chris Nolan cast him. I'm not trying to take credit away completely from Nolan. I'm simply saying that, you know, he got a bit lucky, right? Like he's cast a lot of people in a lot of films, but that is the best performance in a Chris Nolan film, right? And the film is lifted by that in a way that, you know, The Odyssey wasn't by the casting choices. So that's why I've put it at number two, interchangeable almost with Oppenheimer, which is number one, which I think as a cinematic experience is just a masterpiece. And I love Cillian Murphy. I think he's Nolan's best leading man. He's perfectly charismatic for the era that he's working in. Oppenheimer is about something so boring and is so unboring, and it flies by. I don't like, you know, I don't like the style of film necessarily that Nolan has moved into, the kind of Baz Luhrmann effect where, you know, you never really feel settled in any scene. The Odyssey's a little bit like this as well. Dunkirk was a little bit like this. Oppenheimer was kind of the peak of that, where the whole thing feels like a dream sequence. The whole thing feels like no scene has a start or end point, and that you're never really sure where you are when you're watching it. It's so effective in Oppenheimer that even though I don't like that type of storytelling, I love the film. It's just amazing. It's amazing. It's almost faultless, that film. And it, you know, deserved to be an enormous critical success. And similarly to The Odyssey, which I'm sure will be, you know, a huge commercial success as well. I just love it that there's a guy who's able to make films about these sorts of things that sound so boring that everyone in the world goes to see. There's something very exciting to me about that. So I think Odyssey deserves to be top of the list. Sorry, Oppenheimer.
Odyssey.
Oh, my God. Yay. Oh, my God.
Freudian slip.
Freudian
slip.
He's
done it, guys.
That's his next one. It's like Mr. Freud will be the next Nolan film. But that's my list. Now, listen, I feel like you kind of have to give me your quick ranking of those 10. I'm curious how different it would be.
Well, the thing is, I've seen Following, Insomnia, and Batman Begins, so I'd do the full 13.
Right. Okay, well, yeah, and presumably those three are going at the bottom, are they?
Yeah, not far off.
Can you just rank the ones that I've just ranked? Because that way, those are the ones that people have seen. People haven't seen the other one. I mean, I'm sure people have seen Batman Begins, but like that's at the bottom of everyone's list anyway, right?
Yeah, Batman Begins would be at the bottom. Or probably, yeah, fold in with Dark Knight Rises.
My God, England are winning 4-0.
Are you having a laugh?
They're winning 4-0 against France.
Oh, amazing. Should we wrap this up and watch the second half?
Well, let me see how far through the game. It's probably just about to be... It's just about to be half-time. So we've got another, 15, 20 minutes if we do want to watch the second half.
Plum Bottom is The Odyssey.
Really?
Yeah, just because it's the lack of feeling is a problem.
Yeah.
The fight sequences are a problem. And that's only really occurred to me a day later. The scale of it and the spectacle, it looks gorgeous. It was so loud. But it just kept making me think of Dunkirk a lot of the time. The scale, those moments. There's a score motif that is identical to the bit in the submarine. The bit where they're drowned, in Dunkirk, there's a moment where the lads, they get on the ship and then that ship starts sinking. And there's it's one of the most amazing bits of music ever written. I think it's Hans Zimmer. I think it's called Supermarine. It's tension in music. And there's two moments in The Odyssey that are kind of poor man's versions of that. I guess then next would probably be Tenet.
Mm-hmm.
I quite enjoyed it when I first watched it at the cinema.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I was trying to figure it out because it's all about time travel and I love time travel. And I kept trying to figure it out and it was getting in the way of me just getting swept away in the story. And it is a very cold movie. When I rewatched it, I enjoyed it a little bit more. It's willfully obscure. The dialogue is really down in the mix, mm-hmm. and Nolan doesn't care if you understand anything or
sure.
not. And it's just a visceral experience. Ken Branagh's Russian accent I don't like.
Ken Branagh needs to just get out of these movies, let's be honest. Just get him out.
That's got to be 9.
I think, you know, I'm going to have to hustle you ever so slightly, simply because
okay.
I think this might take you an hour otherwise. You're speaking beautifully about each film.
No, because you did it so well. Then The Dark Knight Rises, and that pips Tenet just sure. because Bane is fantastic in that flick. It is too
so
long.
So we agree on our bottom three, not in perfect order, but we essentially we agree that those are the bottom three films.
Yeah.
Then where do we go? I have a feeling you're going to put Oppenheimer here.
This is really difficult. And I think you're right, I'm going to put Oppenheimer here. Although when I rewatched that, I thought, I didn't enjoy that at the cinema, but rewatched it and I thought, this is amazing. What an amazing achievement to make such a boring story. It's so yeah. entertaining. It moves so...
Yeah, man. Yeah. It's more than a film, that film. It's art.
It really wound me up how much everyone loved that. I just thought, what are you all talking about? This film sure. was rubbish. That is such rubbish. but I was glad to eat the humble pie. And then after that would be probably Dunkirk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That, as you say, everything you bang on about Dunkirk, everything you say about that. The scene where the lads are underwater and there's oil on the top. That's cinema.
This is interesting because apart from Memento, I would say, all that's really happened so far is that I've seen your sort of preferences are made clear by where you've put the artier of his top 7 films. Because I think Oppenheimer and Dunkirk are the artiest of the films. And they are near the top of my list, but they're near the bottom of yours, right?
No, they're in the middle.
No, the bottom of your top 7, I'm saying.
Right.
There's clear separation between those bottom 3 and the top 7. The top 7 are all great, great films. The bottom 3 are just good films.
And next is Inception.
Mm-hmm.
I've called on that quite a lot. I haven't rewatched it in a long time.
Worth a rewatch.
Yeah, it is superbly entertaining. I loved it when I saw it. The exposition of it had bugged me on a recent rewatch.
Yeah, there's little bits of it. There's a bit where Tom Hardy's like, "So let me get this straight. If we don't get out of here within an hour, then our brains are going to be scrambled." And I'm watching it thinking, yeah, the other two guys just said that before you as well. But in like, you know, I like that style of exposition, because the first one is like the science explanation for the people who understand everything. Then there's the middle one. The second guy says it again, but says it in a way that's like for your ordinary person. And then the third person says it for anyone in the cinema that still hasn't got it yet, you know.
And this right around, this is where Insomnia would come in, but I'm not allowed to count Insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
Interstellar pips right. Inception, just because there's far more emotion in Interstellar. I think that is his biggest, grandest, as close to masterpiece movie that he's done.
Hard disagree, but fair enough.
And then it's The Dark Knight.
Wow.
And then it's The Prestige.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's Memento.
Yeah, you're two like... The Prestige and Memento, which I think are the most similar films in this list, are your top two. And I knew that they would be. Because you like those sorts of films. And I don't like those sorts of films. I like the Oppenheimer sort of film. And you like the Memento type of film. And that's just where we're different.
The Prestige has just grown and grown for me. I remember seeing it. It was quite coolly received at the time. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yeah, this is good. I subsequently read the book of the same name, written by Christopher Priest. It's not called Written by Christopher Priest. It's called The Prestige.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's a film that just it grows. It's such a small movie. They shot it handheld, by all accounts. So I just listened to a lovely little podcast about
right.
it. It's a fantastic flick. And then Memento's Memento. Memento, no one can come for Memento.
Didn't hate Memento so much, would it be top of your list still?
It's always been top of my list. Okay. But also because it's the formative moment when I saw it.
Yeah.
Christopher Nolan was becoming a movie director and I was becoming a cinephile.
Right.
And it was happening at the same time.
Yeah.
When you watched Memento when he'd already made other movies, I imagine, and you'd watched other things. Christopher Nolan's not your guy. You didn't grow up with Nolan. So you got no relationship with him.
Oh, sorry, I'm not allowed to have it. I'm not. It's just because my first Christopher Nolan film would have been The Dark Knight. I'm not allowed to have a relationship with him.
Your relationship's just grubby and completely different.
Did you watch Following before you watched Memento?
No.
Then you're not allowed to have a relationship with Chris Nolan.